Welcome to Feels Like Healing, a series of conversations between myself, Al Lewis, and individuals who have turned to creativity as a way of helping them heal. Our need for healing is universal, however, the reasons behind it can be oh so varied. A difficult childhood, a traumatic experience, or perhaps a bereavement and our need to process grief. My search for healing stems from the death of my dad, who died when I was 21 from multiple sclerosis. I believe that hearing other people's stories can help us to process ours, and that the act of being creative can help turn something seemingly hopeless and incomprehensible into something beautiful and hopeful. These conversations are here to provide solace and inspiration, and to show you that healing can happen when we take our deepest pain and turn it into a work of art. This is Feels Like Healing. My guest this week on Feels Like Healing is the Associate Professor in the English Department at the University of Bristol, Dr. Liesl Dawson. You might wonder why an Associate Professor at the University of Bristol would be appearing on this podcast, but her academic research explores the links between grief and creativity, and in particular the historical links in literature, and she's also currently writing a book about links between grief and creativity. She's also the arts and culture lead for the Good Grief Festival, which was founded by Lucy Selman, another academic at Bristol University, which aims to engage the wider community in inclusive and positive dialogue about grief. Her work also includes co-producing two short films on children, grief and creativity, partnering with charities on mandatory grief education in schools, and also collaborating on an illustrated booklet on grief and baby loss. So there's plenty to discuss there, as you can tell, with Dr. Liesl Dawson. So hello, Liesl. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you so much for inviting me onto this podcast.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I think, as I've just reeled out there, that you have a lot of experience in this field. So I feel like we have a lot to discuss. First of all, I'm interested to know, I detect a slight accent in your voice, so I take it you are not from Bristol originally. So how did you come about ending up at the University of Bristol?
So that's a nice question. So I'm from California originally. Many, many years ago, I was at UCLA as an undergraduate, and I spent a year at Sussex University, and I had an absolutely wonderful time. So when I finished my BA, I really didn't want to get a job. So I came back to the UK to just keep, you know, being a student for as long as possible. And I went to Oxford and I did my master's, my PhD, and then got a job at Bristol and have just stayed. It wasn't a sort of long-term plan, but where I ended up.
When did this interest in the links in our literature between grief, and was it initially grief that you were exploring, or was it other emotions that came to the fore first when you were doing your research?
So my interest in grief comes from two directions. One's academic and one's personal. I've always been an academic who's interested in the history of emotions and psychology. So my previous work, I've written a book on lovesickness, I've written on shame and revenge and various emotions. So I already had that background. But I also have a personal interest in grief. The background is really that in my childhood, there were two bereavements that happened but weren't really discussed. My mum lost her first baby, her little daughter, and I knew about this. I was interested, but we didn't talk about it. And my uncle also died in a car crash. I didn't really think much about this. I didn't think much about the silence until I had my first child, my son. And he was born very early. He was born at 29 weeks.
Wow.
Yeah, super early. And, yeah. You know, like any premature baby, it was a very eventful happening, very shocking. And then on day three, he stopped breathing. He had to be resuscitated. And then maybe a couple weeks later, we discovered he had a brain bleed. And we weren't sure how severe it was going to be. We weren't sure if he would live or die or the level of impact. And, you know, this was really traumatic. And it made me think about my mom. It made me think about her first baby. Why had she never told me about it? What was this experience like? And I was very interested in my own experience, you know, my own shock, the trauma, and grief about what was happening. And I think it was that that made me want to understand grief more and to really open up conversations about grief and these experiences.
Is your son okay now?
He is. And I think I don't really talk about this story because I guess my story has a happy ending. You know, my son thrived. He did have this brain bleed. He did have a diagnosis of cerebral palsy. You know, but he's an absolutely happy, fabulous, well kid. He, you know, he does tremendously well. He's a para swimmer and he's happy and great. So I think I often, when I'm in a grief context and I'm talking to people who've been bereaved, I don't want to share that story because I somehow feel, you know, a sense of not having a right to talk about that and also wanting to respect people's bereavement. But of course it did connect me, I think, in lots of ways with those emotions and be really interested in other people's experiences and my mom's. And it was actually only through this work and through the booklet that my mom really talked to me about her experiences.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah. Did you and your mom get to have those conversations?
Yeah, eventually. I think when my son was having his difficulty, you know, she found it quite hard even to talk to me. And it brought all those experiences back again. And it's taken a little while. And of course, I had my own pain. But working on the booklet with bereaved parents has been really wonderful. And I sent the booklet to my mom and I said to her, I really, really want to hear about my sister, you know, and, you know, we cried and we talked about it, but it just felt really good. And so it was really nice personally.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing that story. So was that the first time then that you'd decided to look at it from an academic perspective then after your experience with your son?
I'd been thinking about it a bit with revenge, funny enough, because lots of revengers are grievers and they instead of, or, you know, one of the things they do in their grief when if their loved one has been killed is they think, I'm going to get revenge on the person who did this. Mm. So revenge can be a kind of channeling of grief, a redirection of grief. But I think this made me think more about trauma, which I wrote a little bit about, and want to explore those experiences in a bit more detail. And I think creativity is one way. And I myself, when my son was in hospital, I made up lots of stories about him. That was my way of thinking through the experiences. And when he had his diagnosis of cerebral palsy, I made up lots of stories about this. This was my kind of coping mechanism. So I think creativity was there for me as a way of processing.
Did you realize that you were using it as a coping mechanism?
Yeah. Because I think the other thing is my two sort of modes of coping are creativity and self-analysis. And I find intellectualizing, knowing about things for me really, really helps. So when I had a flashback to something, I wanted to know, why do we have flashbacks? What is this? And I think it gave me a different way in to that experience that was less raw. And it made me curious and interested about emotions that might otherwise be hard to hold. So I think I've always known that I do that. I've always told stories and I've always wanted to know the whys. But that was my way in.
And so what was the first project you undertook as someone who then decided, right, this is what I'm going to delve into now? Was it the, it was the film.
Was it the film.
Lost Property?
Yeah. So what happened was the university allowed us to find people who had similar research interests. And I joined a grief group. And that allowed me to meet other academics interested in the subject. And I met Jimmy Hay, who is a filmmaker, whose dad died and who had watched lots of films about death and grief and found a lot of them really disappointing, that the deaths were really straightforward and simple, and the grief was gotten over really quickly with no sense of the way grief is this at times all-encompassing embodied experience. And he wanted to explore, can you make a film that somehow captures some of the bodily experience, you know, some of the oddness, some of the weirdness of grief that isn't so straightforwardly linear or narrative? So we got together with another artist and we made a short fiction film. And we started by talking about our experiences. And then I used a lot of that and turned that into a short story. And then we filmed it and we made it. It's called Lost Property. And it was amazing because we got a whole team of people together on the film. And the first morning, when everybody came for coffee and pastries, everybody revealed their own grief stories.
I was going to say, did they all have a connection to the grief?
They did. And one of the actors had a very close experience to the main character of the film. And the film is about a woman whose ex-husband died. And I think I was wanting to have also that experience of a grief that you can't really talk about, or you don't feel like you can share, and what happens to that. So, but she'd had a similar experience. So it was an amazing experience. And I was really interested in when you take memories, when you take emotions, and you put them into a creative object or product or song, what happens to those emotions? What does it let you do? So Jimmy was really interested in kind of capturing some of the physical experience of grief. And I was really interested in the creative process and what that did to grief.
In the people that I've spoken to about how they've adapted their grief into their creative endeavors, whatever it may be, everybody tackles it in a slightly different way, and therefore it comes out in a slightly different way. And I think that's something that's a message I think that's really important to try and get out to people, is there isn't a right way to grieve, and there isn't a finite timeline, like you say, about grief. It doesn't just sort of, it's not a tap that you can just turn off and then suddenly say, oh, I've grieved.
Yeah.
That's good. That,
yeah,
it was tough,
absolutely.
But I've done it.
It's not linear. Everybody has their own styles of coping. They have their own timelines. You have to be respectful of that. I think that's why with couples, sometimes they have very different grieving styles, and that can actually be a source of anxiety and, you know, tension, that actually each person doesn't understand the other person's grieving style. And I'm interested in your experiences. I read and heard that your dad died when you were 21. Mm-hmm. I've listened to your song, Feels Like Healing.
Yeah.
And I haven't had the opportunity really to speak to many musicians. And it does seem to me that music is such a sort of immediate, visceral way of connecting to emotions. And that song, I wonder if you would just talk a little bit about, if you don't mind me turning the tables on you,
on
that song in particular. And I really, you start and then I have another question.
Well, I think like you say, music is a very powerful tool to emote. And for me, that has been a relationship that I've had for a very long time with music. And it's been a way of me being able to articulate things that I perhaps couldn't put into words, because like you say, there's an unwritten feeling that you get from music, and that was a real catharsis for me to be able to use melody and music as a way of explaining to myself, probably more than anybody, how I was feeling. But to therefore turn the tables on that and to deal directly with grief and my relationship with my dad, it was incredibly healing and eye-opening as well, in that it perhaps allowed me to understand things that I didn't really know were bubbling under the surface. And I think what I've also learned is that a lot of musicians use music because they struggle to talk, and therefore it's not very often that you get musicians perhaps being so open about the themes within their songs, because perhaps they find it too difficult, as I did for 15 years. They find it too difficult, and music is an easier inroad for them to get to their emotions rather than talking, even though I would fully recommend musicians that should talk more as well. But as you've alluded to in what you found from The Lost Property, is that the artistic process enables people to find their singular path towards expressing something that they might find difficult expressing.
Yeah, and creativity is so nice because there's so many different ways in. I mean, again, you talk about music gives you something that's nonverbal, you know, that you don't have to use language, and there's dance and there's sculpting. I work with another woman, Helen Aklam, who says, I think with my hands. And for her, the grieving process is always very embodied and always very physical.
Yeah. And I was interested to see as well that you worked with another guest that we've had, previous guest on the podcast, Gary Andrews. You worked with Gary on an animated short film for children, am I right?
That's right, yeah.
For people who don't know or haven't listened to Gary's episode, Gary is an animator and illustrator who sadly lost his wife, and he used his drawing as his creative outlet for his grief, didn't he? So perhaps you could...
Doodle a day.
You could elaborate a bit more about your relationship with him making that short film.
Yeah, we did two films together, but he was more fully present in that one. So I really wanted to share this sense that creativity is a really helpful way for children, for anyone, but for children as well, to express grief. And as we said, it gives them a nonverbal way in, a different way of communicating, often through play, which is really lovely. And so in that, in Children, Grief and Creativity, we worked with Julia Samuel, who's a wonderful grief psychotherapist. And we start with just some of the real basic do's and don'ts with children, which is telling them the truth, allowing them to feel the range of emotions, anger, you know, everything else, and to express them, to recognize that for children, they might go into the grief and come out of it. You know, the metaphor that's often used is puddle jumping with grief. And also to try to give them opportunities to express their feelings, and also as a way of connecting with the person who's died that they love, and showing that love and showing that connection. And it was really lovely. So Gary and I, we sort of came up with the script, and then Gary and I talked together about the different kinds of illustrations we've used. And then his two children are in it, performing and dancing and doing different things. So it was a really lovely collaborative event. And then I also worked with Victoria Tolchard, who's an art therapist. And we have another short video that talks about specifically the different ways that art therapy can be useful for children.
When we say art therapy, we mean literally the act of drawing. Is that what art therapy is?
Well,
or is it more
I think
than that?
Art therapy in that case, I think, is more about with a therapist. So with somebody who's trained. So she works with kids who've been bereaved, sometimes in groups, sometimes one-on-one. And they'll do drawing, or they'll do sound play, or they'll do different things. And she'll be there to help guide the conversation and to structure the activities. And I think one of the things about play and creativity, there's lots of reasons why creativity is so wonderful, but one of the things about it is it can offer a kind of safe space for people to explore emotions. It gives them a structure. It gives them something to do. It's not simply about them talking, but they can go in via this other, through music or sculpting or dancing or whatever. It gives them a different way in that's a little bit less pressured.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually, because if you keep busy and, yeah, like you say, do something with your hands, it's a real relief, I think. Do you find also, when talking about children, I've found that my daughters can discuss grief, because that's another thing that has been the triggering for me to want to talk about my dad, is the realization that I wanted to talk to my own daughters about him. And if I couldn't do that, then I would feel like I was also just letting them down and not letting them have a more rounded view of their granddad. So, but what I found is that kids can take it on and deal with grief in a far better way than perhaps adults can, do you think?
I think it probably depends on the child, and it depends on if they're bereaved and what they're holding. But I think most children, or a lot of children, can be more straightforward and open. And I think, I mean, this is where the grief education project comes in, really, that my sense is that we need to stop children developing some of the fears and anxieties, the sort of sense of stigma around death, which then stops them as grown-ups being afraid to talk about their own experiences or to reach out and support somebody who's been bereaved. I think, so we've written a policy paper and also an article about grief education. There's been so much work in this field. There are loads of resources for teachers. There's lots of training available that would mean that we could integrate this into schools. And the idea really is that if you allow people to talk about grief and death, not in the aftermath of a bereavement, but as part of their learning, and you can talk about it through biology, you can talk about it through literature, you know, through history and thinking about different cultures. So there's lots of ways in. But if you provide a sense of this and also give children an understanding of the range and intensity of emotions, and also just how to ask questions of other people, how to be supportive, not to be afraid to say the name of someone who's died, that I think we can sort of stop bad habits from forming. And we can help to create a culture that is so much more loving and compassionate and, you know, and less frightened of death and grief, and that we can stand beside each other when we're grieving and when we're dying in a loving, compassionate way and without such a sense of fear.
I think that's a really honourable thing to aim for with our society. I think I had a little experience of grief within the education system, in that I was asked to talk to some pupils at a secondary school a few months back, and I wouldn't say I was shocked, because I was kind of expecting that some of the kids would perhaps not quite know how to deal with this conversation. But it did reinforce in me this idea of what you've said, that we need to incorporate grief into the education system, but not only at the point when someone's bereaved, but like you say, beforehand, and that it can, normalizing it will help everybody, the bereaved and also the people, the support network around the bereaved. I'm fully supportive of those ideas that you have. And do you think we're a long way off getting that into the curriculum, or do you think it's on the horizon?
Well, this is the year that the government is looking at PSHE, RSHE. So this is being looked at and revised. That's the kind of core part of the curriculum that does, you know, these kinds of topics. So this is the moment in some ways to get behind this change. And there has been, so on this, I worked with Tracy Bosley from Childbirth UK, Alison Penny from Childhood Bereavement Network, but also with John Adams from the National Association of Funeral Directors, who started a petition to, you know, put grief education as a mandatory aspect of education. And that was also written with Rachel Hare, I should say, and Lucy Selman, both at the University of Bristol. But John Adams is kind of one of the people leading that campaign. And I think there's so much appetite for this. It would cost money. You know, you do have to invest in teacher training, But there's so many of wonderful organizations out there that already do this that I think it's overdue. And I think it's something we could do to make a really positive change. And teachers themselves often say they want more training and they want to feel confident in this area.
No, I agree. I think it will benefit everybody involved, even the teachers, like you say, and them having the tools to be able to talk to the pupils if forever a pupil needs to talk to about these things with them.
Can I go back to your song for a second?
Yeah, of course.
One thing I found really powerful about it is that you start with this memory of Father's Day and how it was a terrible day for you and it's a really painful day. And the video, you know, we see a kind of image, I think, of your dad. Yeah. And we also see images of your family.
Yeah,
I assume to be. And and the nice thing is that at the end of the song, you talk about how Father's Day is this new event for you. Because you're a dad now, and that sort of movement. And I just was interested, if you don't mind, hearing about how fatherhood, you know, how your experience of fatherhood has connected to you, to your dad. I'm sure it brings up certain kinds of loss, but also there's a sense with your children that you're getting your dad back again, almost internally. I don't know.
There's a lot of conflicting emotions. I think that's what I've found throughout my life, is that those moments that usually are associated with having your family around are bittersweet and will forever remain so, the day of my wedding and the birth of my child, or children I should say, because they're not there to share it with you. But also, like you say, fatherhood for me has given me a different perspective on life and on my grief, and it did force me, like I say, to delve a bit deeper into trying to get to know my dad. I think because he got ill when I was 12 13, so I think I always had this sense that I didn't really have those formative years to get to know him, and he was quite a private man and didn't live with me either. So seeing him sparsely throughout my childhood, I think there were a lot of bits of his personality that I'd missed out on getting to know. Becoming a dad also gives you a sense of your mortality, and but I also think bereavement does that as well. So I think I'd always been aware of my mortality, but even greater when you have your own children. And I think I wanted to document all this in song. And you said earlier about how it's a great way of creativity, is a great way of putting down your feelings towards that person. And I think that was another thing tied up in all of this, is that because men tend not to talk, me and my dad hadn't had those conversations or shared emotions. So in a way, this whole album is me talking to him beyond, in the great beyond. And and getting to that place where these dates in the diary don't drag me down as much because of my children. And I think that's really important thing to remember, that you live on in your children, but also that your parents live on in them, and that you can see reflections of them all in their personalities and in their way of being. And that's a real comfort as well, to know that I can see him in her smile or in her dimple or something like that. And it's been a real journey of being able to open up and talk like we're talking today. I think if I'd have tried to make a podcast like this 5-10 years ago, I wouldn't have been able to. I don't think I could have articulated myself very well, but also it would have been too raw and overwhelming. But what I've realized is that by talking, I mean in particular by talking to people who've gone through something similar or who have experience within this field, that there is a solidarity in that communal experience, and it's an experience that we're all going to have at some point, unfortunately. So that there's a weird comfort in that as well, even us.
Yeah, no, there is. I think, oh, that's so beautiful. Thank you so much. I think you have encapsulated some of the things I think about a lot in terms of creativity and grief. I love the way your songs allow you to have a kind of conversation with your dad. And so many artworks do this. Poetry, where the person who's died kind of speaks back again. Denise Riley has this at the end of one of her poems, which I find really moving. And it's a way of expressing love and kind of carrying on that connection in a new way. I think it gives us that space for that. I also think it allows us to make the person who's died, their presence in our life, more explicit, more obvious. With Gary Andrews, with his doodle a day, his drawings, I love the way that he will draw, you know, his wife Joy, who died, in this different fashion. And of course the rest of us can't see Joy's presence in quite the same way, but by drawing her into those illustrations of their life, it's like the rest of us can see the way Joy is still there for him and for his children, and still, you know, very much part of the family. And I think it also allows other people into your grief experience. It becomes a sort of touchstone for talking to one another about grief.
And do you think that's important for us to...
Hugely important. Hugely important. Yeah. I think because we have lost a lot of the cultural and religious rituals for coming together, for expressing grief, and for getting support, we need to find other ways of coming together and sharing what's happened to us, and form, you know, different rituals or different ways of being. I don't know if you've come across Jane Harris and Jimmy Edmonds' work. They wrote a book called When Words Are Not Enough. They're both artists. She's also a psychotherapist. Their son, Josh, was killed when he was in Vietnam on a moped accident. And they have these amazing grief weekends where bereaved parents come together. They do art activities. They share their grief. And people are active in their grieving. And I think, again, I think that's really crucial to grief.
Absolutely. I think for whatever reason, for my upbringing, my mindset was always the opposite of that, the complete opposite, that you bury it, you don't talk about it, because that's the way to get over it. But I think the more we drum into people the message that it's actually the complete opposite.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the one thing to say too is that repression has a place. You know, denial has a place. When Michael Rosen's son first died, the only way he could get up in the morning was by pretending he was just, his son was somewhere else. You know, I think denial has a kind of coping mechanism to it.
Yeah.
And there's a, I don't know if you've heard about the dual processing model of grief, but this is this idea that in grief, we actually have to move between periods of time where we're focusing on the grief and periods of time where we're not, when we're thinking about other things, when we're distracted. So this is the kind of healthy oscillation within grief. And I think everybody has their own way of dealing with difficult emotions. And I think actually denial is, you know, repression has its place too. We need to be able to do both, to move in and out of those feelings.
Perhaps we could talk a little bit more about some of the other creative projects that you've been involved with. I'm looking particularly at The Guy in the Luggage Rack, which was a theatre production with She Said Jump, am I right?
Yeah. It was that was really wonderful. So that's Maisie Whitehead. She's an artist, a performer. Her mum died. And so this project sort of comes out of her early experience of grief and actually being very much in a state of denial. So it's a really funny, playful, aerial comedy, in fact. And grief is turned into this very large man with a bald head who is the guy in the luggage rack. And essentially, so grief is represented as this figure, and he wants her to notice him and acknowledge him. And she keeps pushing him away. So she keeps, you know, not letting him in the door. And then he turns up in strange places and they kind of argue and fight. So it's very comic and funny. But the movement of the play is really about this character allowing grief to have some space in her life. And there's a kind of key moment when she's at the beach and the character suddenly has this moment of her mom, not of her death, but of just an ordinary happy moment. And so she connects with the grief, but in connecting with the grief, she also really connects with those memories of her mom. And she realizes that by shutting out the grief, she's also shut out that connection. So she has to let sort of both in. It's a really, she's a fantastic artist, and it's great. And she'd already had the show kind of to some extent, but I helped her with a kind of redo of the show and thinking about the structure. Rachel Hare also worked on this as well. And then we got together and we made this little zine to go with the show, which talks about the grief process and uses the show as a way of thinking through the emotions and what happens in grief.
That sounds beautiful. I know you've also been involved with the Crowded Room Theatre Company, where am I right in saying you had workshops where you invited groups of bereaved people in to sort of help formulate the storyline?
This was an amazing project, and I'd actually really like to do this again. I'd like to do this with Crowded Room, but also find a charity who would work with us on this project. So the idea was that they make theater plays and shows that are based off real people's words and lived experience. So in this particular project, we asked people who'd experienced grief to come together in a workshop, and guided by a facilitator, we all together made up a story about a tree in a village that was dying and died. And so we talked about an experience of loss, but it wasn't our specific experience. It was this fictional experience that we created together. And it was really moving and quite amazing. You know, I left, you know, we cried. It was incredible. And then afterward, we did a very small kind of qualitative evaluation where we spoke to people and said, you know, what were your experiences? And my interest was really, again, can doing something original and different with memories and grief experiences, does that offer anything therapeutic and helpful? And I think our sense was, it was a very small, it's just a couple of workshops, was that it was really positive. But I'd love to do it again. And then it was cut together and turned into this audio story.
Do you think the participants would have known or would have been seeking some sort of solace in the creative endeavors they were making?
I think the people who joined were very much people interested in doing this. So it was kind of self-selecting in some sense, which is totally, you know, appropriate. There was one woman who came who had never spoken about her bereavement. Right. She found it impossible. And she said the only reason she could come to this was because it wasn't about her talking. Exact experience. That was her way in. And she was really interesting. And she also talked about in the sort of feedback afterward, how the thing that was also really unexpected was that she found listening to other people talk about their experiences as moving and healing as her being able to talk in this sort of roundabout way about what had happened. So that was fascinating. And I think really does show our need for not just talking, but listening, and also lots of different ways in for us to think about and feel things, you know, the emotions of what's happened.
And I suppose that's kind of what you're doing with the festival, isn't it? With your colleague Lucy Selman, Good Grief Festival. That's all about promoting discussions about grief and getting people to talk and listen, like you say, to other people's stories. And I'm interested to know what you've personally got out of the festival, but also what you're seeing in the response from the wider public to the festival.
I've loved it so much. My original idea for a book was another more scholarly Renaissance book about grief and creativity. But the minute I started working with people in the festival, I thought, no, this is what I want to do. It's been a huge privilege. And I love having conversations about important things. You know, people often say, that's so sad. But actually, I find it inspiring and I find it really meaningful. And I think that really we just want to allow for different voices out there to try to destigmatize grief, to make the range of emotions seem more normal. And it's been fantastic. And we do everything for free. So we kind of rely on different grants that we get and things like that. So we can just make it really publicly accessible. But it's been a huge pleasure. And I hope there's loads of good charities out there doing amazing things. But I hope we're also doing a little part in moving the conversation forward.
If we sort of would look back at the you before you started this or this journey, do you think your relationship with grief and the power of creativity has changed, or your perspective on it has changed over the years?
I think I've learned a lot. I've always been a bit of a California oversharer. I think I probably have gotten worse or better depending on your view. I absolutely, you know, you talk about your kids. I actually talk to my kids all the time about death and grief and loss, about my own death, about other people's deaths, you know. So I think it's probably made me even more that way. And yeah, so I think it has changed me a bit. But also, I just feel so immensely grateful that I get to do something that I care about so passionately. So it's been wonderful.
What would you say feels like healing for you? What are the activities? Because, you know, your academic work is to talk about death. What do you use in your life to help you with healing for whatever reason you might need to?
I think I'm somebody who, like you, likes creativity. I like being active. Michael Rosen talks about, you know, he sees this as the doing cure, doing something rather than talking, but I like talking too. But I think more than anything, for me, it's about human connection. So, you know, this conversation, the conversations I have with people on Good Grief are the thing that really inspire me and somehow make the scary topics less scary, and also something that makes me think about how precious and, you know, fragile life is. And, you know, when my kids go out, well, when Laura goes out on a bike, you know, I always think she could die every time, because I know that can happen. And so when she comes home, I'm very happy she's made it home. I know that sounds crazy, but I know that I can die anytime. And I feel very happy each day that I'm still here.
Yeah.
Which I know sounds ludicrous, but I really do feel like that. I think it's given me that sense of the time limited aspect of life. In a positive way.
Because I suppose that's one thing, isn't it, when you're talking about grief and death, is to not be overwhelmed by the sadness of it, but to flip it the other way and to appreciate, like you say, the beauty and the gift that is life.
Absolutely. I think that's beautiful. Yeah. You said it perfectly.
Well, Liesl, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast. It's been a pleasure talking to you and to hear your insights. All the best with the book. I look forward to reading that when it comes out. Do you think that will be a bookmark for you on grief, or do you think grief is your lifetime project now, grief and creativity, or do you think the book will be something that will allow you to move in a different direction?
I don't know. I think I love this so much. I think I'd want to stay in something to do with mental health, but I think there's a lot more to be said about grief. There's always new areas. So I'm not sure, but watch this space.
Watch this space. Dr. Liesl Dawson, thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Please help by rating and subscribing to this podcast, as it will help to spread the word about Feels Like Healing. Thanks for listening.